and we got down to business immediately. I told him I wanted to see Kobi Kotsi, the Minister of Justice. He asked me, why? I hesitated for a moment, reluctant to discuss political matters with a prison official, but I responded with frankness. I want to see the minister in order to raise the question of talks between the government and the ANC. He pondered this for a moment and then said, Mandela, as you know, I am not a politician. I cannot discuss such issues myself, for they are beyond my authority. He then paused, as if something had just occurred to him. It just so happens, he said, that the Minister of Justice is in Cape Town. Perhaps you can see him. I will find out. The general then telephoned the minister, and the two spoke for a few moments. After putting down the phone, the general turned to me and said, the minister said, bring him round. Minutes later, we left the general's residence in his car, bound for the minister's house in Cape Town. Security was light. Only one other car accompanied the general's vehicle. The ease and rapidity with which this meeting was set up made me suspect that the government might have planned this rendezvous ahead of time. Whether they had or not was immaterial. It was an opportunity to take the first step toward negotiations. At his official residence in the city, Kotsi greeted me warmly, and we settled down on comfortable chairs in his lounge. He apologized that I had not had a chance to change out of my prison clothes. I spent 3 hours in conversation with him and was struck by his sophistication and willingness to listen. He asked knowledgeable and relevant questions, questions that reflected a familiarity with the issues that divided the government and the ANC. He asked me under what circumstances would we suspend the armed struggle, whether or not I spoke for the ANC as a whole, whether I envisioned any constitutional guarantees for minorities in a new South Africa. His questions went to the heart of the issues dividing the government and the ANC. After responding in much the same way as I did to the eminent persons group, I sensed that Kotsi wanted some resolution. What is the next step? He asked. I told him I wanted to see the state president and the foreign minister, Pik Botha. Kotsi noted this on a small pad he had kept beside him and said he would send my request through the proper channels. We then shook hands and I was driven back to my solitary cell on the ground floor of Polesmoor Prison. I was greatly encouraged. I sensed the government was anxious to overcome the impasse in the country, that they were now convinced they had to depart from their old positions. In ghostly outline, I saw the beginnings of a compromise. I told no one of my encounter. I wanted the process to be underway before I informed anyone. Sometimes it is necessary to present one's colleagues with a policy that is already a fait accompli. I knew that once they examined the situation carefully, my colleagues at Polesmoor and in Lusaka would support me. But again, after this promising start, nothing happened. Weeks and then months passed without a word from Kotsi. In some frustration, I wrote him another letter. Chapter 91. Although I did not get a direct response from Kobi Kotsi, there were other signs that the government was preparing me for a different kind of existence. On the day before Christmas, Lieutenant Colonel Gawi Marks, the deputy commander of Polesmoor, wandered by my cell after breakfast and said, quite casually, Mandela, would you like to see the city? I was not exactly certain what he had in mind, but I thought there was no harm in saying yes. Good, he said. Come along. I walked with the colonel through the 15 locked metal doors between my cell and the entrance, and when we emerged, I found his car waiting for us. We drove into Cape Town along the lovely road that runs parallel to the coast. He had no destination in mind, and simply meandered around the city in a leisurely fashion. It was absolutely riveting to watch the simple activities of people out in the world, old men sitting in the sun, women doing their shopping, people walking their dogs. It is precisely those mundane activities of daily life that one misses most in prison. I felt like a curious tourist in a strange and remarkable land. After an hour or so, Colonel Marks stopped the car in front of a small shop on a quiet street. "Would you like a cold drink?" he asked me. I nodded, and he disappeared inside the shop. I sat there alone. For the first few moments, I did not think about my situation. But as the seconds ticked away, I became more and more agitated. For the first time in 22 years, I was out in the world and unguarded. I had a vision of opening the door, jumping out, and then running and running until I was out of sight. Something inside was urging me to do just that. I noticed a wooded area near the road where I could hide. I was extremely tense and began to perspire. Where was the colonel? But then I took control of myself. Such an action would be unwise and irresponsible, not to mention dangerous. It was possible that the whole situation was contrived to try to get me to escape, though I do not think that was the case. I was greatly relieved a few moments later when I saw the colonel walking back to the car with 2 cans of Coca-Cola. As it turned out, that day in Cape Town was the first of many excursions. Over the next few months, I went out again with the colonel, not only to Cape Town, but to some of the sights around the city, its beautiful beaches and lovely, cool mountains. Soon, more junior officers were permitted to take me around. One of the places I regularly visited with these junior officers was known as the Gardens, a series of small holdings on the edge of the prison grounds where crops were grown for the prison's kitchen. I enjoyed being out in nature, being able to see the horizon and feel the sun on my shoulders. One day I went to the gardens with a captain, and after walking in the fields, we strolled over to the stables. There were 2 young white men in overalls, working with the horses. I walked over to them, praised one of the animals, and said to the fellow, "Now, what is this horse's name?" The young man seemed quite nervous and did not look at me. He then mumbled the name of the horse, but to the captain, not me. I then asked the other fellow in turn what the name of his horse was, and he had precisely the same reaction. As I was walking back to the prison with the captain, I commented on what I thought was the curious behavior of the 2 young men. The captain laughed. "Mandela, don't you know what those 2 chaps were?" I said I did not. "They were white prisoners. They had never been questioned by a native prisoner in the presence of a white officer before." Some of the younger warders took me quite far afield, and we would walk on the beach and even stop at a cafe and have tea. At such places, I often tried to see if people recognized me, but no one ever did. The last published picture of me had been taken in 1962. These trips were instructive on a number of levels. I saw how life had changed in the time I had been away, and because we mainly went to white areas, I saw the extraordinary wealth and ease that whites enjoyed. Though the country was in upheaval and the townships were on the brink of open warfare, white life went on placidly and undisturbed. Their lives were unaffected. Once, one of the warders, a very pleasant young man named Warrant Officer Brand, actually took me to his family's flat and introduced me to his wife and children. From then on, I sent his children Christmas cards every year. As much as I enjoyed these little adventures, I well knew that the authorities had a motive other than keeping me diverted. I sensed that they wanted to acclimatize me to life in South Africa, and perhaps at the same time get me so used to the pleasures of small freedoms that I might be willing to compromise in order to have complete freedom. Chapter 92. In 1987, I resumed contact with Kobe Kotze. I had several private meetings with him at his residence, and later that year, the government made its first concrete proposal. Kotze said the government would like to appoint a committee of senior officials to conduct private discussions with me. This would be done with the full knowledge of the state president, Kotze said. Kotze himself would be head of the committee, and it would include General Willemse, the Commissioner of Prisons, Fanny Vandermeer, the Director General of the Prisons Department, and Dr. Neil Barnard, a former academic who was then head of the National Intelligence Service. The first three individuals were associated with the prison system, so if talks foundered or were leaked to the press, both sides would be able to cover up and say we were discussing prison conditions and nothing more. The presence of Dr. Barnard, however, disturbed me. He was the head of South Africa's equivalent of the CIA and was also involved with military intelligence. I could justify to my organization discussions with the other officials, but not Barnard. His presence made the talks more problematic and suggested a larger agenda. I told Kotze that I would like to think about the proposal overnight. That night, I considered all the ramifications. I knew that P.W. Botha had created something called the State Security Council, a shadowy secretariat of security experts and intelligence officials. He had done this, according to the press, to circumvent the authority of the cabinet and increase his own power. Dr. Barnard was a key player in this inner council and was said to be a protege of the president. I thought that my refusing Barnard would alienate Botha, and I decided that such a tech was too risky. If the state president was not brought on board, nothing would happen. In the morning, I sent word to Kotze that I accepted his offer. I knew that I had three crucial matters that I needed to address. First, I wanted to sound out my colleagues on the third floor before I proceeded any further. Second, it was essential to communicate with Oliver in Lusaka about what was occurring. And finally, I intended to draft a memorandum to P.W. Botha, laying out my views and those of the ANC on the vital issues before the country. This memorandum would create talking points for any future discussion. I requested a meeting with my colleagues, and, to my surprise, the authorities summarily refused. This was remarkable, and I assumed it reflected a great deal of nervousness about the prospect of secret talks between myself and the government. I took my complaints to more senior officials. Finally, the request was approved, with the proviso that I could see my colleagues one by one, not together. I met them in the visiting area. I had resolved to leave out a few details. I would seek their counsel about the idea of having talks with the government without mentioning that an actual committee had been formed. Walter was first. I told him about my letter to the Commissioner of Prisons and my meeting with Kotze. I said that I had discussed with Kotze the idea of beginning talks with the government, and that the government seemed interested. What were his views on the matter? I have been through thick and thin with Walter. He was a man of reason and wisdom, and no man knew me better than he did. There was no one whose opinion I trusted or valued more. Walter considered what I told him. I could see he was uncomfortable, and at best, lukewarm. In principle, he said, I am not against negotiations, but I would have wished that the government initiated talks with us rather than us initiating talks with them. I replied that if he was not against negotiations in principle, what did it matter who initiated them? What mattered was what they achieved, not how they started. I told Walter that I thought we should move forward with negotiations and not worry about who knocked on the door first. Walter saw that my mind was made up, and he said he would not stop me, but that he hoped I knew what I was doing. Next was Raymond Ndlaba. I explained the entire situation to him as I had to Walter. Ray was always a man of few words, and for several moments he digested what I had said. He then looked at me and said, Madiba, what have you been waiting for? We should have started this years ago. Andrew Mlangeni's reaction was virtually the same as Ray's. The last man was Kathy. His response was negative. He was as resolutely against what I was suggesting as Raymond and Andrew were in favor. Even more strongly than Walter, he felt that by initiating talks, it would appear that we were capitulating. Like Walter, he said he was not in principle against negotiations, and I responded exactly as I had with Walter. But Kathy was adamant. He felt I was going down the wrong path. But, despite his misgivings, he said he would not stand in my way. Not long after this, I received a note from Oliver Tambo that was smuggled into me by one of my lawyers. He had heard reports that I was having secret discussions with the government, and he was concerned. He said he knew I had been alone for some time and separated from my colleagues. He must have been wondering, what is going on with Mandela? Oliver's note was brief and to the point. What, he wanted to know, was I discussing with the government? Oliver could not have believed that I was selling out, but he must have thought I was making an error in judgment. In fact, the tenor of his note suggested that. I replied to Oliver in a very terse letter saying that I was talking to the government about one thing and one thing only, a meeting between the National Executive Committee of the ANC and the South African government. I would not spell out the details, for I could not trust the confidentiality of the communication. I simply said the time had come for such talks and that I would not compromise the organization in any way. Although the ANC had called for talks with the government for decades, we had never been confronted with the actual prospect of such talks. It is one thing to consider them in theory, and quite another to engage in them. As I was writing my response to Oliver, I was also beginning to draft my memorandum to P.W. Botha. I would make sure that Oliver saw this as well. I knew that when Oliver and the National Executive read my memo, their fears that I had gone off the road would be allayed. Chapter 93. The first formal meeting of the secret working group took place in May 1988 at a posh officers' club within the precincts of Polesmoor. While I knew both Coetzee and Willemse, I had never before met Vandermeer and Dr. Barnard. Vandermeer was a quiet, level-headed man who spoke only when he had something important to say. Dr. Barnard was in his mid-thirties and was exceedingly bright, a man of controlled intelligence and self-discipline. The initial meeting was quite stiff, but in subsequent sessions we were able to talk more freely and directly. I met with them almost every week for a few months, and then the meetings occurred at irregular intervals, sometimes not for a month, and then suddenly every week. The meetings were usually scheduled by the government, but sometimes I would request a session. During our early meetings, I discovered that my new colleagues, with the exception of Dr. Barnard, knew little about the ANC. They were all sophisticated Afrikaners and far more open-minded than nearly all of their brethren. But they were the victims of so much propaganda that it was necessary to straighten them out about certain facts. Even Dr. Barnard, who had made a study of the ANC, had received most of his information from police and intelligence files, which were in the main inaccurate and sullied by the prejudices of the men who had gathered them. He could not help but be infected by the same biases. I spent some time in the beginning sketching out the history of the ANC and then explaining our positions on the primary issues that divided the organization from the government. After these preliminaries, we focused on the critical issues, the armed struggle, the ANC's alliance with the Communist Party, the goal of majority rule, and the idea of racial reconciliation. The first issue to arise was in many ways the most crucial, and that was the armed struggle. We spent a number of months discussing it. They insisted that the ANC must renounce violence and give up the armed struggle before the government would agree to negotiations and before I could meet President Botha. Their contention was that violence was nothing more than criminal behavior that could not be tolerated by the state. I responded that the state was responsible for the violence, and that it is always the oppressor, not the oppressed, who dictates the form of the struggle. If the oppressor uses violence, the oppressed have no alternative but to respond violently. In our case, it was simply a legitimate form of self-defense. I ventured that if the state decided to use peaceful methods, The ANC would also use peaceful means. It is up to you, I said, not us, to renounce violence. I think I advanced their understanding on this point, but the issue soon moved from a philosophical question to a practical one. As Minister Coetzee and Dr. Barnard pointed out, the National Party had repeatedly stated that it would not negotiate with any organization that advocated violence. Therefore, how could it suddenly announce talks with the ANC without losing its credibility? In order for us to begin talks, they said, the ANC must make some compromise so that the government would not lose face with its own people. It was a fair point, and one that I could well understand, but I would not offer them a way out. Gentlemen, I said, it is not my job to resolve your dilemma for you. I simply told them that they must tell their people that there can be no peace and no solution to the situation in South Africa without sitting down with the ANC. People will understand, I said. The ANC's alliance with the Communist Party seemed to trouble them almost as much as the armed struggle. The National Party accepted the most hidebound of 1950s Cold War ideology and regarded the Soviet Union as the evil empire and communism as the work of the devil. There was nothing that one could do to disabuse them of this notion. They maintained that the Communist Party dominated and controlled the ANC, and that in order for negotiations to begin, we must break with the party. First of all, I said, no self-respecting freedom fighter would take orders from the government he is fighting against or jettison a long-time ally in the interest of pleasing an antagonist. I then explained at great length that the party and the ANC were separate and distinct organizations that shared the same short-term objectives, the overthrow of racial oppression and the birth of a non-racial South Africa, but that our long-term interests were not the same. This discussion went on for months. Like most Afrikaners, they thought that because many of the communists in the ANC were white or Indian, they were controlling the blacks in the ANC. I cited many occasions when the ANC and the CP had differed on policy and the ANC had prevailed, but this did not seem to impress them. Finally, in exasperation, I said to them, "You gentlemen consider yourselves intelligent, do you not? You consider yourselves forceful and persuasive, do you not? Well, there are four of you and only one of me, and you cannot control me or get me to change my mind. What makes you think the communists can succeed where you have failed?" They were also concerned about the idea of nationalization, insisting that the ANC and the Freedom Charter supported blanket nationalization for the South African economy. I explained that we were for a more even distribution of the rewards of certain industries, industries that were already monopolies, and that nationalization might occur in some of those areas. But I referred them to an article I wrote in 1956 for Liberation, in which I said that the Freedom Charter was not a blueprint for socialism, but for African-style capitalism. I told them I had not changed my mind since then. The other main area of discussion was the issue of majority rule. They felt that if there was majority rule, the rights of minorities would be trampled. How would the ANC protect the rights of the white minority, they wanted to know. I said that there was no organization in the history of South Africa to compare with the ANC in terms of trying to unite all the people and races of South Africa. I referred them to the preamble of the Freedom Charter. South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white. I told them that whites were Africans as well, and that in any future dispensation the majority would need the minority. "We do not want to drive you into the sea," I said. Chapter 94. The meetings had a positive effect. I was told in the winter of 1988 that President Botha was planning to see me before the end of August. The country was still in turmoil. The government had reimposed a state of emergency in both 1987 and 1988. International pressure mounted. More companies left South Africa. The American Congress had passed a sweeping sanctions bill. In 1987, the ANC celebrated its 75th anniversary and held a conference at the end of the year in Tanzania, attended by delegates from more than 50 nations. Oliver declared that the armed struggle would intensify until the government was prepared to negotiate the abolition of apartheid. 2 years before, at the ANC's Kabwe conference in Zambia, marking the 30th anniversary of the Freedom Charter, members of other races were elected to the National Executive Committee for the first time, and the NEC pledged that no discussions with the government could be held until all ANC leaders were released from prison. Although violence was still pervasive, the National Party had never been stronger. In the white general election of May 1987, the Nationalists won an overwhelming majority. Worse still, the Liberal Progressive Federal Party had been replaced as the official opposition by the Conservative Party, which was to the right of the Nationalists and campaigned on the theme that the government was too lenient with the black opposition. Despite my optimism about the secret talks, it was a difficult time. I had recently had a visit from Winnie, and I learned that 8115 Orlando West, the house in which we had been married, and which I considered home, had been burned down by arsonists. We had lost invaluable family records, photographs, and keepsakes, even the slice of wedding cake Winnie was saving for my release. I had always thought that someday, when I left prison, I would be able to recapture the past when looking over those pictures and letters. And now they were gone. Prison had robbed me of my freedom, but not my memories. And now I felt some enemies of the struggle had tried to rob me of even those. I was also suffering from a bad cough that I could not seem to shake, and I often felt too weak to exercise. I had continued to complain about the dampness of my cell, but nothing had been done about it. One day, during a meeting in the visiting area with my attorney, Ismail Ayob, I felt ill and vomited. I was taken back to my cell, examined by a doctor, and I soon recovered. A few days later, however, I was in my cell after dinner when a number of warders and a doctor arrived. The physician gave me a cursory examination, and then one of the warders told me to get dressed. "We are taking you to hospital in Cape Town," I was told. Security was tight. I went in a convoy of cars and military vehicles accompanied by at least a dozen warders. I was taken to Tigerberg Hospital on the campus of the University of Stellenbosch in a rich and verdant area of the Cape. As I later discovered, they had nearly chosen a different facility because the authorities feared I might attract sympathetic attention at a university hospital. The warders went in first and cleared everyone out of the entrance area. I was then escorted up to a floor that had been entirely emptied. The whole of the floor was lined with more than a dozen armed guards. While sitting on a table in the examining room, I was looked at by a young and amiable doctor who was also a professor at the university medical school. He inspected my throat, tapped my chest, took some cultures, and in no time pronounced me fit. "There is nothing wrong with you," he said with a smile. "We should be able to release you tomorrow." I was anxious not to be diverted from my talks with the government, so I was pleased with his diagnosis. After the examination, the doctor asked me if I would like some tea. I said I would, and a few minutes later, a tall, young, colored nurse came in with a tray. The presence of all the armed guards and warders so frightened her that she dropped the tray on my bed, spilling the tea before rushing out. I spent the night in the empty ward under heavy guard. The first thing the next morning, even before I had breakfast, I was visited by an older doctor who was head of internal medicine at the hospital. He was a no-nonsense fellow and had far less of a bedside manner than the cordial young physician of the night before. Without any preliminaries, he tapped me roughly on my chest and then said gruffly, "There is water in your lung." I told him that the previous doctor had done tests and said I was fine. With a hint of annoyance, he said, "Mandela, take a look at your chest." He pointed out that one side of my chest was actually larger than the other, and said that it was probably filled with water. He asked a nurse to bring him a syringe, and without further ado, he poked it into my chest and drew out some brownish liquid. "Have you had breakfast?" he said. "No," I replied. "Good," he said. "We are taking you to the operating theater immediately." He told me I had a great deal of water on my lung, and he wanted to draw it out right away. In the operating room, I was given anesthesia, and the next thing I recalled was waking up in a room with the doctor present. I was groggy, but I concentrated on what he said. He had removed 2 liters of water from my chest, and when the liquid was analyzed, a tuberculosis germ had been discovered. He said it was in the very early stages of the illness, and that the germ had done no damage to the lung. "While full-blown tuberculosis normally took 6 months to cure," he said, "I should be better in 2 months." The doctor agreed that it was probably the damp cell that had helped cause my illness. I spent the next 6 weeks at Tigerberg recuperating and receiving treatment. In December, I was moved to the Constantiaberg Clinic, a luxurious facility near Polesmoor that had never had a black patient before. My first morning there, I had an early visit from Kobe Kotze, who was accompanied by Major Marais, a deputy commander responsible for looking after me. We had barely exchanged greetings when the orderly brought in my breakfast. Because of my recent illness and my history of high blood pressure, I had been put on a strict low cholesterol diet. That order had apparently not yet been conveyed to the clinic's kitchen, for the breakfast tray contained scrambled eggs, 3 rashers of bacon, and several pieces of buttered toast. I could not remember the last time I had tasted bacon and eggs, and I was ravenous. Just as I was about to take a delicious forkful of egg, Major Marais said, "No, Mandela, that is against the orders of your physician," and he reached over to take the tray. I held it tightly and said, "Major, I am sorry. If this breakfast will kill me, then today I am prepared to die." Once I was ensconced at Constantiaberg, I again began to meet with Kobe Kotze and the secret committee. While I was still at the clinic, Kotze said he wanted to put me in a situation that was halfway between confinement and freedom. While he did not spell out what this meant, I had a notion of what he was talking about, and I merely nodded. I would not be so naive as to consider his proposal to be freedom, but I knew that it was a step in that direction. In the meantime, the clinic was extremely comfortable, and for the first time, I actually enjoyed a hospital convalescence. The nurses, who were white or colored, no black nurses were permitted, spoiled me. They brought extra desserts and pillows and were constantly visiting, even during their time off. One day, one of the nurses came to me and said, "Mr. Mandela, we are having a party tonight and we would like you to come." I said I'd be honored to attend, but that the authorities would undoubtedly have something to say about it. The prison authorities refused permission for me to go, which nettled the nurses, and as a result, they decided to hold their party in my room, insisting they could not have their party without me. That night, a dozen or so of these young ladies in party frocks descended on my room with cake and punch and gifts. The guards seemed befuddled, but they could hardly consider these vivacious young girls a security risk. In fact, when one of the guards attempted to prevent some of the nurses from entering my room, I jestingly accused him of being jealous of an old man receiving so much attention from such beautiful young ladies. Chapter 95. In early December 1988, security on my ward was tightened, and the officers on duty were more alert than usual. Some change was imminent. On the evening of December 9th, Major Marais came into my room and told me to prepare myself to leave. "Where to?" I asked him. He could not say. I packed my things and looked around for some of my loyal nurses. I was disappointed at not being able to thank them and bid them farewell. We left in a rush, and after about an hour on the road, we entered a prison whose name I recognized, Victor Förster. Located in the lovely old Cape Dutch town of Paarl, Victor Förster is 35 miles northeast of Cape Town in the province's wine-growing region. The prison had the reputation of being a model facility. We drove through the entire length of the prison and then along a winding dirt road through a rather wild, wooded area at the rear of the property. At the end of the road, we came to an isolated, whitewashed, one-story cottage set behind a concrete wall and shaded by tall fir trees. I was ushered into the house by Major Marais and found a spacious lounge next to a large kitchen with an even larger bedroom at the back of the house. The place was sparsely but comfortably furnished. It had not been cleaned or swept before my arrival, and the bedroom and living room were teeming with all kinds of exotic insects, centipedes, monkey spiders, and the like, some of which I had never seen before. That night, I swept the insects off my bed and windowsill and slept extremely well in what was to be my new home. The next morning, I surveyed my new abode and discovered a swimming pool in the backyard and two smaller bedrooms. I walked outside and admired the trees that shaded the house and kept it cool. The entire place felt removed, isolated. The only thing spoiling the idyllic picture was that the walls were topped with razor wire and there were guards at the entrance to the house. Even so, it was a lovely place and situation, a halfway house between prison and freedom. That afternoon, I was visited by Kobe Kotze, who brought a case of Cape wine as a housewarming gift. The irony of a jailer bringing his prisoner such a gift was not lost on either of us. He was extremely solicitous and wanted to make sure that I liked my new home. He surveyed the house himself, and the only thing he recommended was that the walls outside the house be raised. For my privacy, he said. He told me that the cottage at Victor Förster would be my last home before becoming a free man. The reason behind this move, he said, was that I should have a place where I could hold discussions in privacy and comfort. The cottage did in fact give one the illusion of freedom. I could go to sleep and wake up as I pleased, swim whenever I wanted, eat when I was hungry. All were delicious sensations. Simply to be able to go outside during the day and take a walk when I desired was a moment of private glory. There were no bars on the windows, no jangling keys, no doors to lock or unlock. It was altogether pleasant, but I never forgot that it was a gilded cage. The prison service provided me with a cook, Warrant Officer Swart, a tall, quiet Afrikaner who had once been a warder on Robben Island. I did not remember him, but he said he sometimes drove us to the quarry and purposely steered the truck over bumps to give us a rocky ride. "I did that to you," he said sheepishly, and I laughed. He was a decent, sweet-tempered fellow without any prejudice, and he became like a younger brother to me. He arrived at 7 in the morning and left at 4 and would make my breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I had a diet outlined by my physician, and he would follow it in his preparations. He was a lovely cook, and when he went home at 4, he would leave me supper to heat up in the microwave oven, a device that was new to me. Warrant Officer Swart baked bread, made home-brewed ginger beer, and assorted other delicacies. When I had visitors, which was increasingly often, he would prepare gourmet meals. They always praised the food, and I dare say my chef was the envy of all my visitors. When the authorities began to permit some of my ANC comrades and members of the United Democratic Front, UDF, and the Mass Democratic Movement, MDM, to visit me, I accused them of coming only for the food. One day, after a delicious meal prepared by Mr. Swart, I went into the kitchen to wash the dishes. "No," he said. "That is my duty. You must return to the sitting room." I insisted that I had to do something, and that if he cooked, it was only fair for me to do the dishes. Mr. Swart protested, but finally gave in. He also objected to the fact that I would make my bed in the morning, saying it was his responsibility to do so. but I had been making my own bed for so long it had become a reflex. We also traded off in another respect. Like many Afrikaans-speaking warders, he was keen to improve his English. I was always looking for ways to improve my Afrikaans. We made an agreement. He would speak to me in English, and I would answer in Afrikaans. And in that way, we both practiced the language at which we were weakest. I would occasionally ask him to make certain dishes for me. I sometimes requested samp and beans, which I used to eat as a boy. One day I said to him, "You know, I would like you to cook me some brown rice." To my astonishment, he said, "What is brown rice?" Swart was a young man, and I explained to him that brown rice was the unrefined rice kernel, and we used to eat it during the war when white rice was unavailable. I said it was far healthier than white rice. He was skeptical, but managed to find me some. He cooked it, and I enjoyed it very much. But Mr. Swart could not abide the taste and vowed that if I ever wanted it again, I would have to cook it myself. Even though I was not a drinker, I wanted to be a proper host and serve wine to my guests. I would occasionally take a sip of wine in order to make my guests feel comfortable, but the only wine I can stomach is a South African semi-sweet wine, which is actually very sweet. Before my guests came, I would ask Mr. Swart to get a certain type of Niederberg wine, which I had tasted before and knew was a semi-sweet. One day, I was expecting my friends and lawyers for lunch, Dulla Omar, George Bisos, and Ismail Ayob, and asked Mr. Swart to purchase some Niederberg wine should George Bisos, not a Muslim, want some with his meal. I noticed that he grimaced when I said this and asked him what was wrong. "Mr. Mandela," he said, "I always buy that wine for you because you ask me to, but it is cheap stuff and not very nice." I reminded him that I did not like dry wines, and I was sure George could not tell the difference anyway. Mr. Swart smiled at this and proposed a compromise. He would go out and buy two bottles, a dry wine and my Niederberg, and then he would ask my guest which wine he preferred. "Fine," I said. "Let us try your experiment." When all four of us were seated for lunch, Swart came out holding the two bottles and turned to the guests and said, "Gentlemen, which wine would you like?" Without even looking at me, George pointed to the bottle of dry white. Warrant Officer Swart just smiled. Chapter 96. The meetings with the committee continued, and we stalled on the same issues that had always prevented us from moving forward: the armed struggle, the Communist Party, and majority rule. I was still pressing Kotze for a meeting with P.W. Botha. By this time, the authorities permitted me to have rudimentary communications with my comrades at Polesmore and Robben Island, and also the ANC in Lusaka. Although I knew I was going out ahead of my colleagues, I did not want to go too far ahead and find that I was all alone. In January 1989, I was visited by my four comrades from Polesmore, and we discussed the memorandum I was planning to send to the state president. The memorandum reiterated most of the points I had made in our secret committee meetings, but I wanted to make sure the state president heard them directly from me. He would see that we were not wild-eyed terrorists, but reasonable men. "I am disturbed," I wrote to Mr. Botha in the memorandum sent to him in March, "as many other South Africans no doubt are, by the specter of a South Africa split into two hostile camps, blacks on one side and whites on the other, slaughtering one another. To avert this and prepare the groundwork for negotiations, I proposed to deal with the three demands made of the ANC by the government as a precondition to negotiations: renouncing violence, breaking with the SACP, and abandoning the call for majority rule. On the question of violence, I wrote that the refusal of the ANC to renounce violence was not the problem. The truth is that the government is not yet ready for the sharing of political power with blacks. I explained our unwillingness to cast aside the SACP and reiterated that we were not under its control. "Which man of honor," I wrote, will desert a lifelong friend at the insistence of a common opponent and still retain a measure of credibility with his people. I said the rejection of majority rule by the government was a poorly disguised attempt to preserve power. I suggested he must face reality. Majority rule and internal peace are like the two sides of a single coin, and white South Africa simply has to accept that there will never be peace and stability in this country until the principle is fully applied. At the end of the letter, I offered a very rough framework for negotiations. Two political issues will have to be addressed. Firstly, the demand for majority rule in a unitary state. Secondly, the concern of white South Africa over this demand, as well as the insistence of whites on structural guarantees that majority rule will not mean domination of the white minority by blacks. The most crucial tasks which will face the government and the ANC will be to reconcile these two positions. I propose that this be done in two stages, the first being a discussion to create the proper conditions for negotiations, the second being the actual negotiations themselves. I must point out that the move I have taken provides you with the opportunity to overcome the current deadlock and to normalize the country's political situation. I hope you will seize it without delay. But delay there was. In January, P.W. Botha suffered a stroke. While it did not incapacitate the president, it did weaken him and, according to his cabinet, made him even more irascible. In February, Botha unexpectedly resigned as head of the National Party, but kept his position as state president. This was an unparalleled situation in the country's history. In the South African parliamentary system, the leader of the majority party becomes the head of state. President Botha was now head of state, but not of his own party. Some saw this as a positive development, that Botha wanted to be above party politics in order to bring about true change in South Africa. Political violence and international pressure continued to intensify. Political detainees all across the country had held a successful hunger strike, persuading the Minister of Law and Order to release over 900 of them. In 1989, the UDF formed an alliance with the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, to form the Mass Democratic Movement, MDM, which then began organizing a country-wide defiance campaign of civil disobedience to challenge apartheid institutions. On the international front, Oliver held talks with the governments of Great Britain and the Soviet Union, and in January 1987, met with the U.S. Secretary of State, George Shultz, in Washington. The Americans recognized the ANC as an indispensable element of any solution in South Africa. Sanctions against South Africa remained in force and even increased. Political violence also had its tragic side. As the violence in Soweto intensified, my wife permitted a group of young men to act as her bodyguards as she moved around the township. These young men were untrained and undisciplined and became involved in activities that were unbecoming to a liberation struggle. Winnie subsequently became legally entangled in the trial of one of her bodyguards who was convicted of murdering a young comrade. This situation was deeply disconcerting to me, for such a scandal only served to divide the movement at a time when unity was essential. I wholly supported my wife and maintained that while she had shown poor judgment, she was innocent of any serious charges. That July, for my 71st birthday, I was visited at the cottage at Victor Förster by nearly my entire family. It was the first time I had ever had my wife and children and grandchildren all in one place, and it was a grand and happy occasion. Warrant Officer Swart outdid himself in preparing a feast, and he did not even get upset when I permitted some of the grandchildren to eat their sweets before their main course. After the meal, the grandchildren went into my bedroom to watch a video of a horror movie, while the adults stayed outside gossiping in the lounge. It was a deep, deep pleasure to have my whole family around me, and the only pain was the knowledge that I had missed such occasions for so many years. Chapter 97. On July 4th, I was visited by General Valemse, who informed me that I was being taken to see President Botha the following day. He described the visit as a courtesy call, and I was told to be ready to leave at 5:30 a.m. I told the general that while I was looking forward to the meeting, I thought it appropriate that I have a suit and tie in which to see Mr. Botha. The suit from the visit of the Eminent Persons Group had long since vanished. The general agreed, and a short while later, a tailor appeared to take my measurements. That afternoon, I was delivered a new suit, tie, shirt, and shoes. Before leaving, the general also asked me my blood type, just in case anything untoward should happen the following day. I prepared as best I could for the meeting. I reviewed my memo and the extensive notes I had made for it. I looked at as many newspapers and publications as I could to make sure I was up to date. After President Botha's resignation as head of the National Party, F.W. de Klerk had been elected in his place, and there was said to be considerable jockeying between the two men. Some might interpret Botha's willingness to meet me as his way of stealing thunder from his rival, but that did not concern me. I rehearsed the arguments that the state president might make and the ones I would put in return. In every meeting with an adversary, one must make sure one has conveyed precisely the impression one intends to. I was tense about seeing Mr. Botha. He was known as the Great Crocodile, and I had heard many accounts of his ferocious temper. He seemed to me to be the very model of the old-fashioned, stiff-necked, stubborn Afrikaner who did not so much discuss matters with black leaders as dictate to them. His recent stroke had apparently only exacerbated this tendency. I resolved that if he acted in that finger-wagging fashion with me, I would have to inform him that I found such behavior unacceptable, and I would then stand up and adjourn the meeting. At precisely 5:30 in the morning, Major Murray, the commander of Victor Förster, arrived at my cottage. He came into the lounge where I stood in front of him in my new suit for inspection. He shook his head from side to side. "No, Mandela, your tie," he said. One did not have much use for ties in prison, and I realized that morning when I was putting it on that I had forgotten how to tie it properly. I made a knot as best I could and hoped no one would notice. Major Murray unbuttoned my collar, loosened and then removed my tie, and then, standing behind me, tied it in a double Windsor knot. He then stood back to admire his handiwork. "Much better," he said. We drove from Victor Förster to Paulsmoor to the residence of General Valemse, where we were served breakfast by the general's wife. After breakfast in a small convoy, we drove to Tuenways, the official presidential office, and parked in an underground garage where we would not be seen. Tuenways is a graceful 19th-century Cape Dutch-style building, but I did not get a proper look at it that day. I was essentially smuggled into the presidential suite. We took an elevator to the ground floor and emerged in a grand wood-paneled lobby in front of the president's office. There we were met by Kobe Coetzee and Neil Barnard and a retinue of prison officials. I had spoken extensively with both Coetzee and Dr. Barnard about this meeting, and they had always advised me to avoid controversial issues with the president. While we were waiting, Dr. Barnard looked down and noticed that my shoelaces were not properly tied, and he quickly kneeled down to tie them for me. I realized just how nervous they were, and that did not make me any calmer. The door then opened, and I walked in expecting the worst. From the opposite side of his grand office, P.W. Botha walked toward me. He had planned his march perfectly, for we met exactly halfway. He had his hand out and was smiling broadly, and in fact, from that very first moment, he completely disarmed me. He was unfailingly courteous, deferential, and friendly. We very quickly posed for a photograph of the two of us shaking hands, and then were joined at a long table by Kobi Kotze, General Willemse, and Dr. Barnard. Tea was served, and we began to talk. From the first, it was not as though we were engaged in tense political arguments, but a lively and interesting tutorial. We did not discuss substantive issues so much as history and South African culture. I mentioned that I had recently read an article in an Afrikaans magazine about the 1914 Afrikaner Rebellion, and I mentioned how they had occupied towns in the Free State. I said I saw our struggle as parallel to this famous rebellion, and we discussed this historical episode for quite a while. South African history, of course, looks very different to the black man than to the white man. Their view was that the rebellion had been a quarrel between brothers, whereas my struggle was a revolutionary one. I said that it could also be seen as a struggle between brothers who happened to be different colors. The meeting was not even half an hour and was friendly and breezy until the end. It was then that I raised a serious issue. I asked Mr. Botha to release unconditionally all political prisoners, including myself. That was the only tense moment in the meeting, and Mr. Botha said that he was afraid that he could not do that. There was then a brief discussion as to what we should say if news of the meeting leaked out. We very quickly drafted a bland statement saying that we had met for tea in an effort to promote peace in the country. When this was agreed upon, Mr. Botha rose and shook my hand, saying what a pleasure it had been. Indeed, it had been. I thanked him and left the way we had come. While the meeting was not a breakthrough in terms of negotiations, it was one in another sense. Mr. Botha had long talked about the need to cross the Rubicon, but he never did it himself until that morning at Tuenwe's. Now, I felt, there was no turning back. A little more than a month later, in August 1989, P.W. Botha went on national television to announce his resignation as state president. In a curiously rambling farewell address, he accused cabinet members of a breach of trust, of ignoring him, and of playing into the hands of the African National Congress. The following day, F.W. de Klerk was sworn in as acting president and affirmed his commitment to change and reform. To us, Mr. de Klerk was a cipher. When he became head of the National Party, he seemed to be the quintessential party man, nothing more and nothing less. Nothing in his past seemed to hint at a spirit of reform. As education minister, he had attempted to keep black students out of white universities. But as soon as he took over the National Party, I began to follow him closely. I read all of his speeches, listened to what he said, and began to see that he represented a genuine departure from his predecessor. He was not an ideologue, but a pragmatist, a man who saw change as necessary and inevitable. On the day he was sworn in, I wrote him a letter requesting a meeting. In his inaugural address, Mr. de Klerk said his government was committed to peace and that it would negotiate with any other group committed to peace. But his commitment to a new order was demonstrated only after his inauguration, when a march was planned in Cape Town to protest police brutality. It was to be led by Archbishop Tutu and the Reverend Alan Bosack. Under President Botha, the march would have been banned, marchers would have defied that ban, and violence would have resulted. The new president lived up to his promise to ease restrictions on political gatherings and permitted the march to take place, only asking that the demonstrators remain peaceful. A new and different hand was on the tiller. Chapter 98. Even as de Klerk became president, I continued to meet with the secret negotiating committee. We were joined by Gerrit Viljoen, the Minister of Constitutional Development, a brilliant man with a doctorate in classics whose role was to bring our discussions into a constitutional framework. I pressed the government to display evidence of its good intentions, urging the state to show its bona fides by releasing my fellow political prisoners at Polesmoor and Robben Island. While I told the committee that my colleagues had to be released unconditionally, I said the government could expect disciplined behavior from them after their release. That was demonstrated by the conduct of Govan Mbeki, who had been unconditionally released at the end of 1987. On October 10th, 1989, President de Klerk announced that Walter